Rebels take Tripoli and a new day dawns for Libya.
A look at what the new country and economy might look like.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for downloading our podcast. It's Monday, August 22nd.
Coming up, the Fed fesses up. Turns out that at the height of the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve made as much as $1 trillion in secret loans to banks.
And we'll hear why Turkey is expanding its nuclear power presence as most of the rest of the world is cutting back.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Rebel forces in Libya have reportedly seized control of the country this morning. After more than 40 years of rule by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan people and economy will need a lot of help getting back on their feet. Here to talk about what the new Libya might look like is journalist and commentator Nabila Ramdani. Good morning, Nabila.
Good morning.
We're hearing a lot this morning about oil. Obviously, Libya's got a lot of oil. Would that potentially be the centerpiece to a new economy?
Very much so, and I would contend that was one of the reasons why the West joined in the war in Libya for a start, because of its vast oil reserves. And we're already seeing in Tripoli conflicts between various factions vying for oil revenues. So there's already tribal rivalries, regional rivalries about who should get control of those oil revenues.
The rebel forces have been talking with European countries already, from what I understand, about oil shipments and other economic ties. How fast do you expect that would get up to speed?
One of the conditions for everything to fall in place is the reestablishment of law and order in the first instance, the management of security and policing. You cannot possibly have foreign companies coming into the country if it's a lawless country. So I think that will be the priority of not only the rebel forces, but most importantly of NATO. So that's going to be a huge challenge.
Right. Well, I mean, we've seen how oil-rich countries like Iraq, the promises of oil revenue haven't paid off because of political issues and things like that. Do you expect that to be the case in Libya, or what will that depend on?
I think there's a real danger for that. We're already seeing, as I said, various factions vying for control over oil revenues. Control over oil and gas revenue is going to be absolutely crucial in holding together the different tribes. And let's not forget that Libya historically is a country which is entrenched with tribal rivalries, with regional rivalries. So there's a real danger of seeing Libya not remaining a single entity.
Nabila Ramdani is a journalist and commentator specializing in Middle Eastern affairs. Thank you so much, Nabila.
Thank you.
As we've heard all morning, rebel forces have moved into the Libyan capital of Tripoli. At this point, the rebels say they don't know where Gaddafi is, but they're looking. World leaders are calling on Gaddafi to surrender. Experts expect if the rebel victory holds, global oil prices will fall as Libya starts producing oil again. Before the current uprising, Libya supplied 2% of the world's oil, and a lot of that went to Europe, where markets bounced today. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Adrian.
So we have optimistic news coming out of Libya right now, but it's still early, and we don't really know how quickly the rebels could establish a working government and economy. So why have we seen this immediate dip in the price of oil?
Well, to an extent, this is a knee-jerk reaction, but Libya was a big oil producer before the civil war, pumping around 1.6 million barrels a day, as you say, around 2% of the global daily demand, and with the potential, geologists say, to pump as much as 3 million barrels a day. So the loss of Libyan oil was one of the factors keeping the world price higher than it would otherwise have been. When this oil comes back on the market, there will be extra supply, and that clearly will help push prices down.
And when is that going to happen? When could we see oil actually coming out of Libya again? And how much oil are we talking about?
Well, of course, we don't know the answer to either of those questions, really. But analysts believe that we could see about half the pre-conflict level of production, 800,000 barrels a day, back on the market fairly soon after Gaddafi falls and a new government is formed. Nick McGregor, who's an oil analyst with brokers Redmayne Bentley, says oil production will be the first priority of any new government. Such will be the scale and cost of reconstruction the country needs.
The first thing any new regime is going to do is look to resurrect exports. It's so crucial to the overall financing for any future regime that they'll be very keen to start exporting as quickly as possible.
How soon the rest of that 1.6 million barrels a day comes onto the market, of course, depends on how much damage the conflict has done to Libya's oil infrastructure.
OK, put this into the bigger picture for me, if you don't mind. How much of a difference will this make to global oil prices in the long run?
Well, Libyan oil, the possible availability of Libyan oil is not the most important factor weighing on the oil market. The price of oil has been under downward pressure for some weeks on growing concern about the possibility of a double-dip recession in the US and Europe. That's a more significant factor. And it's interesting to note that over recent weeks, the difference between the two great oil price benchmarks, West Texas, the American benchmark, and Brent, have widened significantly. West Texas is now much cheaper than Brent. Largely, it's believed, because West Texas, because it's delivered in the heart of the US, is a much more directly exposed to worries about the US economy. Brent, on the other hand, is used more widely as a benchmark for oil supply to the emerging economies, and so is reflecting less worry about a downturn.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks so much.
Okay, Adrian.
Now, here's an interesting piece of news, Adrian. It turns out that at the height of the housing crisis, the financial crisis, the Fed made more than $1 trillion in secret loans to banks.
Now, that's bigger than the TARP bailout.
I know. Bloomberg actually released that report on the loans today. And Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story now.
The loans were supposed to remain a secret, but the Fed was forced to bear all after a Freedom of Information Act request. According to Bloomberg, the Fed lent the most to Morgan Stanley, which got as much as $107 billion. Citigroup got about $99 billion. At the height of the financial crisis, the Fed changed the rules to make things easier for the banks. It accepted risky collateral to back the loans, like junk bonds and stocks. The Fed insists the loans and easier rules were a good risk because it didn't lose any money. That doesn't wash with Len Blum, a managing partner at Westwood Capital.
That argument doesn't ring true to me. It's like someone saying they went to Las Vegas, but it was safe because they won.
Blum says there are better ways to keep the banks stable. Chief among them, require banks to have a bigger stockpile of cash on hand in case of emergency. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
So, Adrian, the king is dead.
What do you mean?
Burger
it sounds
King
worrisome,
is,
Stacey.
I know. Sorry, especially today. But Burger King is dropping its king mascot. You know, the one that had the big head, the big plastic head?
I love the king mascot. I actually, like, those are some ads that I actually look forward to on television.
Oh, you know, I always found them a little weird.
They are weird. Maybe that says something about me.
No. I mean, obviously, you know, this is like a national campaign. But apparently Burger King says it's going to focus more on the freshness of its food. It wants to appeal to mothers and healthy eaters and focus less on you know, the creepy, grinning king.
We know where you stand on this.
I know.
But I can imagine it might not have been good for selling burgers. Amusement. The Chicago Federal Reserve Bank released its National Activity Index this morning, which shows economic activity improved in July. It's a check in the plus column for the market, still reeling from last week's swings. Now investors are shifting their attention to the Fed, wishing they could read the mind of Bernanke ahead of a Friday speech in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. There are rumors he might announce new plans to goose the economy. On Mondays, we normally talk to BNP Paribas economist Julie Coronado. She's out. So we're joined today instead by Bill Stone, chief investment strategist for PNC Wealth Management. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So optimism in these markets seems to be the theme this morning. Is it Libya? Is it Bernanke? Or is it something else?
You know, I think it's a little bit of something else in terms of just a lot of negative news being priced into the markets. We've been beaten down pretty far, so I do think we were, they call it due for a bounce. Certainly the Libya part, I think it's helped as well, just giving us at least one more positive news. And you know, there's certainly some optimism out there regarding what Bernanke may talk about at Jackson Hole.
Now, what options does Bernanke have? We've talked a lot about what he can't do. What tools does he have?
Well, I think, you know, he's already laid out that being more explicit about the extended period of low rates, well, he can be more explicit about how long they may continue to reinvest the assets that the Fed has. He could talk about changing the composition of the portfolio to some extent, what type of bonds, maybe the maturity of those bonds. And lastly, he could actually discuss more purchases.
Now, we also found out today that the Fed quietly, during the financial crisis of 2008, basically secretly loaned more than $1 trillion to banks. What do you make of that?
You know, I think it gives you probably just more, evidence of the severity of the liquidity crunch that we had going on during that time. You know, I believe all of those were really collateralized loans. So it really shows you that even though a lot of the financial companies may have, in fact, had collateral, no one was willing to step in and lend to them except for perhaps the Fed.
Bill Stone, I'm going to have to stop you there. Sure. Bill Stone is the chief investment strategist for PNC Wealth Management. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
News the Federal Reserve might intervene to keep the U.S. economy from dipping back into recession has markets on the rise. More numbers anytime at our website, marketplace.org. Just go to the numbers section.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Today, the Japanese government released some sobering news about the Fukushima nuclear power plant. Residents and businesses won't be able to go back. The area around the plant will be uninhabitable for years because of radiation levels. Meanwhile, Turkey is looking to get into nuclear power. It has plans to build 3 reactors. The government says it's needed to drive Turkey's fast-growing economy. But there are some doubters, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Germany, Switzerland, and Italy are all phasing out nuclear power. But just days after the Fukushima disaster, the Turkish government promised it's going ahead with plans for nuclear energy. And since then, it's been pushing to speed up the construction of the 3 proposed plants. Not all Turks are on board, though, and many have been taking to the streets, even here in Istanbul, which is far from the nearest proposed site. Johnson Ilgaz is an environmental activist with Greenpeace.
I don't want a life where I have to risk everything. I don't want that life for my eventual kids.
Right now, Turkey uses all kinds of energy. Oil, natural gas, coal, wind. Vural Altın is a nuclear physicist in Istanbul, and he agrees that nuclear power can be dangerous, but so is, say, mining coal or being dependent on others for energy.
In matters of energy, there is no single answer. Energy security means distributing the risks between different baskets.
He thinks nuclear should be in one of those baskets. Neither the Turkish Energy Department nor the Atomic Regulatory Commission would talk to me. But the government has said repeatedly that Turkey needs nuclear energy to keep powering its economy, which is the fastest growing in the world right now. A lot of Turkey's $70 billion trade deficit comes from importing energy. Meanwhile, protesters like Johnson Ilgaz say they'll keep fighting until Turkey's government gives up. But for its part, the government says construction on the first plant will start any day now, at a site on the Mediterranean coast, which is just miles from an active fault line. In Istanbul, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
So, Stacey, you may know Capital One from their offbeat and often aired What's in Your Wallet ads.
The Visigoths.
Exactly. Exactly. But Capital One is more than a credit card company. Over the last few years, it's snatched up 3 retail banks. Now it wants to conquer online. But some consumer groups say not so fast. They worry the bank's grown too big too quickly. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Capital One's offered to buy ING Direct for about $9 billion in cash and stock. For that kind of money, what would it get? Henry Coffey is an analyst with Stern AG.
A bunch of deposits, a bunch of investments, a bunch of cash, plus this very robust platform.
ING's web-based bank. It's a direct depository, a bank with no branches.
From a bank's point of view, you get the ability to grow and scale an operation without having to invest in a lot of bricks and mortar.
Capital One announced the deal in June, and since then, many consumer groups have spoken out against it. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition.
They're actually creating, believe it or not, the 5th largest depository institution in the United States.
He argues Capital One's acquisitions haven't benefited consumers, that the bank has lent less and less to small businesses and offers fewer government-backed mortgages. And Taylor says the last thing the U.S. needs is another big bank, especially as regulators decide what institutions, if any, are too big to fail.
Everybody's waiting, but it hasn't come out.
That's Karen Petru with Federal Financial Analytics. Last week, Congressman Barney Frank asked the Federal Reserve to take more time to decide if the acquisition passes muster. Capital One wouldn't talk to us, but a bank spokesman said in a statement the deal wouldn't result in greater risk to the stability of the U.S. banking system. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
So, Adrian, where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina.
A fellow person from the stick.
Exactly.
So I grew up in Idaho, and I don't know about you, but we were always very slow to get all kinds of services.
Yes, I'm with you.
As it turns out, this is still the case. Only 60% of rural Americans have access to broadband. Kind of surprising.
It is.
And today, the Department of Agriculture is announcing millions of dollars for small communities throughout the country to change that, as Jennifer Collins reports.
Steph Larson lives on a farm in Nebraska. To get internet there, she had to build a Wi-Fi receiver.
One of our neighbors happened to have a 30-foot utility pole that he wasn't using, so we bartered, I think it was a bushel of cherries.
And even now, Larson's internet is barely fast enough to stream a Netflix movie. Today, Nebraska is one of 16 states that will get USDA money to provide broadband. Kurt Scharf is a tech analyst with Parks Associates. He says large telecom companies won't offer high-speed internet if they can't get enough subscribers to pay for the infrastructure.
In some cases, you do need a government entity to come in and basically subsidize services to these smaller rural and underserved areas.
Steph Larson, whose day job is with the Center for Rural Affairs, says today's announcement is not enough.
There's still so many people who can't access customers, they can't access their legislators, they can't access government grants because they don't have internet access.
Because she says it's hard to get ahead today with an internet connection from the 1990s. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Speaking of rural, Stacey, I have some interesting country news.
Really?
Yes. Interesting and silly country news. A runaway cow has been evading authorities in Germany since May. And this is like a 1,500-pound dairy cow somehow is able to like hide in the woods using its cow stealth. I don't know. I have no... Yes, really.
Cow stealth. I love that.
According to the Daily Telegraph, locals have gone high-tech to try to find this cow. They've used scooters. They've had sniffing dogs. They've gotten helicopters with thermal cameras. And they haven't captured this cow. So now they're back to the basics. One searcher told the Telegraph, quote, "We have found cow pats, very fresh ones, and we will follow the trail."
Man, good luck to them. I have a feeling that this cow could teach us a thing or two about, it's like James Bond's
cow
or something like that. Well, what can you say after that, Adrian? Nothing.
Let's just say goodbye.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.